This is the time set for oral argument for the Southern Panel of the Supreme Court, consisting of myself, James Hardesty, Justice Pickering, and Justice Douglas. We have on our first, as our first case, Lamb v. State, case number 51457. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your
Honor. Okay. All right. Ms. Kazumka, you ready to go?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christine Kazemka. I'm the lawyer representing Mr. Lamb on this matter this morning. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Justice. This case is yet another example of prosecutors overreaching in order to get a conviction. Mr. Lamb was not entitled to a perfect trial, although he was most certainly entitled to a fair trial. In this case, prosecutors managed to admit piece after piece of inadmissible, prejudicial evidence while at the same time systematically and purposefully excluding relevant probative evidence, evidence that would have been part of the defense's theory of this case. Mr. Lamb was denied that very fundamental and critical right, that being a fair trial. The final blow came when the jurors, during deliberation, sent a note out to the bailiff. Despite this very lopsided presentation of this trial, they were torn between first and second degree murder. The bailiff decided he would handle it on his own. He didn't contact the court, the lawyers. He responded to the jurors directly. We don't have a record of that.
Counsel, was there, from your position as to this last comment, how was defense prejudiced by the bailiff's response? I can concur with you based upon what I understand. It was error, but why is it not harmless? Is there prejudice as to the response that, as we understand it?
Well, in addition to the errors of certain evidence being excluded that went to our theory of the case.
Specifically, just the bailiff. I'm just talking about that little of what he did.
Well, we found out about this after the trial, after the penalty phase. On inquiry, we found out that he got the note from the jury and responded to it orally, did not preserve the note, did not notify the court or the lawyers about this note. The note was allegedly, what is the difference between first degree and second degree murder? How it's prejudicial is that Mr. Lamb was convicted of first degree murder. The jury had been deliberating for 9 hours, had indicated they were deadlocked.
What was the alleged response back from the bailiff?
To refer to the jury instructions.
And how did that specific comment prejudice the defendant?
Well, if you look at the elements of first degree murder, being premeditation, deliberation, and having the intent, you know, the line of cases were blurring the difference between premeditation and deliberation. Perhaps we could have given a clarifying instruction, being that deliberation is distinguished from premeditation in that one weighs the consequences for and against a particular act. That's how it prejudiced Mr. Lamb. But we don't know because the note's not in the record. It was not preserved. So if the jury was deadlocked for 9 hours, after 9 hours of deliberation, then this note followed, what is the difference between first and second degree murder? The verdict came in 30 minutes later. There seems to have been a very significant question, and this is prejudicial, that it wasn't preserved. We don't know. It's the bailiff's rendering of what
Forgive me, I didn't have a chance to look at this part of the record, but was there an evidentiary hearing where Judge Mosley resolved the communication by the bailiff to the jury?
We
I say resolved, made findings.
We filed a motion for a new trial based on this, and the judge denied it.
But was there an evidentiary hearing, or did you request one in the context of that motion, and were any of the jurors called to substantiate or refute the communication by the bailiff?
No jurors were called. Mr. Nickmeyer was called. and he testified as to his recollection of the note being what is the difference between first and second degree murder.
And did the judge, in his order denying your motion, make findings with respect to the communication? Did he find that the communication was as harmless? Represented by the bailiff?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. We'll make a note of that.
But he did deny our motion.
Okay. Maybe you might want to move on to another topic. You talked about the sufficiency of the evidence and the exclusion of evidence that would have helped your client, but you might, also be interested in the Miranda issue.
Do you want to hear about the Miranda issue right now?
Whichever order you'd like to take them in.
All right. Let me talk about the Miranda issue then. As it relates to Mr. Lamb's being taken into custody outside of his apartment and then at the Clark County Detention Center. The officer showed up at his apartment. He was taking trash out. They apprehended him, put him in handcuffs, and on the pavement in the parking lot, a great distance from his apartment. They then started questioning him as to whether or not he had a gun in his apartment. And he responded, "We moved to suppress that statement in that he should have been Mirandized." He wasn't. Specifically, Detective Granchini testified that he didn't Mirandize Mr. Lamb prior to asking him these questions because he was concerned for the safety of anybody in the apartment. Well, the public safety exception goes to whether or not the public is in danger or the suspect has access to the weapon.
Well, there's a very interesting difference of opinion in the cases about the reach and elements of the public safety exception. And what I'd like to know is, in the context of this case, which of those should this panel adopt or consider, and why?
Well, I think the panel should adopt the line of cases whereby the public safety exception is there to prevent the public from being in danger. Here, this was in his apartment. In the line of cases where they've justified going into someone's vehicle that was left on the side of the road, it could be vandalized by the public, and whatever weapon was in there, they could get their hands on. In this case, the public didn't have access to Mr. Lamb's apartment, and in fact, the police got a search warrant for the apartment shortly thereafter. And that's why I believe that it was error that he was not Mirandized before these questions were asked of him on the pavement while he was handcuffed. He posed no threat to those officers. And he was a great distance away from his apartment.
But doesn't that also cut in favor? I mean, that's a neutral fact in some respects because the distance from his apartment, we don't know whether his apartment was locked or unlocked, whether the door was open or closed. Crediting the district court's finding that there was a public safety exception that applied here, are you inviting us to second-guess that determination? And under what cases do you say that's appropriate?
I think the lower court got it wrong. I don't recall that there was an issue about whether or not the apartment was open to the public or whether or not the door was unlocked. And the best of my memory, I don't recall that.
I'm just trying to understand how you would distinguish the car being vandalized from the apartment being vandalized. I mean,
the car being out on a public road, it's easier to smash a window in of the car as opposed to deliberately going to one of several hundred apartments and targeting. I mean, we could all say that if we have firearms in our houses, anyone is subject to coming and getting them, but it doesn't necessarily follow that the same standard for potential vehicle vandalism is the same as that of a person's private residence.
Well, let's assume we agree with you that the interrogation was inappropriate. They should have stopped earlier in terms of their questioning of him. How did the statement, I had a gun, but I found it, or I lost my gun, but I found it, and then they go in the apartment and find the gun, but the gun is different from the weapon that killed the decedent, correct?
Correct.
So how did the admission of that statement, assuming you're right and it should not have been elicited, harm your client?
Makes it look like he was evasive to the officers and not being truthful, which could have hurt his defense. Do you have guns? Yes, I have a gun. It wasn't, the decedent was killed with a .22. He didn't have one in his apartment. So the jurors hearing this can jump to a conclusion that he's a bad guy.
Because he had a gun in his apartment?
In the context of the whole case, and also by his responses, well, maybe I do, as memory serves me, looking evasive to the jury. Shall I move on?
Yes. One of the areas I wanted to pose a question about had to do with the authentication of the writings. Mr. Silverstein appeared to object to that, but then he represented that these were authenticated in the preliminary hearing. Is there a rule or a statute or a case that compels the trial judge to authenticate these separately at trial when they've been authenticated in the preliminary hearing as represented by defense counsel?
I think the difference is the ability to cross-examine the person who did the authentication of the writings. In this case, I believe it was Mr. Bivens.
Well, but my question is there a rule or a statute or a case that compels that to occur at trial when the authentication has occurred at the prelim as represented by defense counsel?
That I don't know at this point, Justice.
Okay. You have 3:30 if you want to address the evidence issues, or you can rebut, whichever you prefer.
3:30 left total?
Yes, ma'am. I'll give you an
extra.
I'll
save it for rebuttal.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. DiGiacomo.
May it please the court. My name is Mark DiGiacomo. I represent the state of Nevada in this particular case. I want to address each one of the points raised by the defense, but I also think that the court should go to the record when making any sort of determination, because I want to first start out by answering Justice Douglas's question on the new trial. There was no harm to the defendant for multiple reasons, one of which, and to Justice Hardesty, the court did have an evidentiary hearing. The only thing submitted by the defense in this evidentiary hearing was an affidavit from Mr. Silverstein concerning his conversations with the bailiff or marshal, Mr. Nickmeyer. The judge called Mr. Nickmeyer to the stand. Mr. Nickmeyer testified. At the end of that, the judge made some findings about, hey, this is exactly what Mr. Nickmeyer told me and you, Mr. Silverstein, in chambers. There wasn't any representative of the state there at the time. And this comports with my understanding. Mr. Silverstein, do you have any other questions about whether or not this is true or not true? And so Mr. Silverstein said, no, that's it. Well, if a jury asks the question between the difference of first-degree murder and second-degree murder, then the answer to that question, and don't get me wrong, I'm not here defending what the bailiff did in this particular case, but the answer to that question has to be, refer to your instructions, because this court has told us the only instructions we can give them on that is, if we choose to define premeditation and deliberation, is Byford, and those instructions were the instructions provided to the jury. So there was no other thing that the judge could have done or could have said or any other thing that would have happened to that jury other than them being referred back to their instructions. So there's no way to find anything other than harmless error. I think the issue I'd like to address, secondly, because we can do it very quickly, I think, is the exclusion of the evidence proffered by defendant. The suggestion in this case is that somehow the state did something, I think she called it overreaching. This is the evidence they wanted to get in. Well, first of all, they wanted to accuse a Dr. Earl Cottrell, a local doctor, of committing a murder, and they said it in their opening statement. He did it. He doesn't have an alibi. He's the guy who did it, with absolutely a single shred of evidence to support that. And they complained when we said, who's Dr. Earl Cottrell? And, oh, by the way, we're going to find him and we're going to call him as a witness and allow him to deny that he committed this murder. Thereafter, during the cross-examination of Velma Cottrell, who was a friend of the victim in this particular case, they asked her, hey, was Susan part of your divorce? No. Was your husband upset at all about the divorce? No. Thereafter, the defense wanted to start asking her questions about threats that she'd made to Mr. Cottrell in some family court documents and things that he had said to her from the family court documents. And the judge said, look, without some sort of foundation that the victim in this particular case was part of that, then it's not admissible. It's not relevant. So you have to establish that first. They failed to establish it in one single shred of evidence.
Wasn't there a statement to the police by the decedent's husband that her killer would have been either one of two people, her brother or this Mr. Cottrell?
That was what was represented by the defense. The actual evidence was, and both Stu Bivens and Detective Gibson testified to it, that when they went to the husband immediately after learning about the death down at the school, the husband said, look, if she's dead, her brother did it. You know, we're having this long history of problems. And after this long conversation about the brother, he says, is there anybody else on earth that you could think of that would have a problem with your wife? Anybody? And Stu was like, no, I really can't. You sure there's not anybody? He goes, well, you know, her best friend got divorced. Maybe her husband wasn't happy about the fact that he got divorced. That was the extent of the evidence that Mr. Cottrell or Dr. Cottrell had some sort of animosity towards Susan Bivens. Absolutely not a single shred of other evidence of that. The last thing was is they claimed that we excluded photo lineups. Well, yeah, we excluded the 130 photo lineups as hearsay. They could call any one of the individuals to get up the stand and say, yes, I looked at a photo lineup, I didn't pick anybody out. But they were able to cross-examine Detective Gibson about, you showed 130 photo lineups. And he says, yes, I did, to the people at the school who were not witnesses to the murder. I showed every one of them to see if anyone had ever seen the defendant near the school previously. And they were able to get that evidence in. So nothing was excluded by from the defense. Which kind of brings us to the Miranda issue, because, you know, I read these briefs, and after Polk, I'm a little nervous about saying some of this, but... you know, the fact of the matter is that the briefs do not make it clear that there are four separate statements of the defendant that were admitted, or not admitted, but were part of this motion to suppress. When the cops first contact him based on reasonable suspicion and take him into custody, kind of like a Terry stop situation, there's a question about his name, which we all know the officers have a right to demand the identity of an individual, in which his answers are, I hit my head, I don't really remember. Well, do you have some ID? Yeah, I have my license on me. The next thing that Officer Branchini says to him for officer safety was, hey, is there not any guns? He says, are there any people, any dogs, or any weapons in that apartment that we have to worry about? And the response from the defendant was, I have a revolver, but I found it. Something to that effect. Thereafter, he's asked, hey, will you come down and speak to us at the police station? He says, I don't want to, but I will. They take him down there. He's Mirandized. And this goes into some of my cross-examination questions. Thereafter, he sticks with, I don't really remember my name. They show him a picture of Susan Vince. He says, pretty lady, what happened to her? It clearly is indicating to them certain things. And then finally, he invokes. They take him down to the jail to book him on PC for murder. By this time, they've searched the apartment and everything else. And when they book him on the murder, they ask him his name, and he says, I don't really remember. And the booking person kind of goes, hey, look, buddy, it's a hell of a lot easier if you just tell us your name, otherwise we're going to book you as John Doe. And at that point he goes, okay, my name's Robert Lamb, my social security number is this, and he gives all the other identifying information. And then later, even though this was never admitted, there was a time when the officers went to execute a search warrant for a buckle. Mr. Lamb makes certain voluntary statements not in response to interrogation. So the question is what's the admissibility of the first statement when the police officers contact him? I think it's what the court's concerned with. Even though the defense has raised that somehow it was inappropriate for me to cross-examine him on his Mirandized statements that he made to the police back at the police station. In our brief, we talk about two things, which is booking-type questions and public safety-type questions. Well, I think the first hurdle you're going to have to get over as a court is whether or not Miranda applies to the situation at all. Berkemer versus McCarty says that in a Terry stop type situation, there isn't Miranda warnings required, and that's what the judge ruled upon on the lower level.
Mr. Giacomo, there are about four different circuit courts that have opined on this public safety issue, and to be fair, they've kind of made some distinctions between public safety or general public safety as well as safety of police.
Correct, they have.
As we asked the defense, if we were to come down and make a ruling in terms of how this public safety exception works, what would be your preference for the word?
Well, obviously, as a person who's in law enforcement, certainly I would think that the safety of the officer is no different than the safety of the public. I mean, you have to ask yourself, what was Detective Brancini actually asking him? Was he looking for evidence to implicate this particular individual in a murder, or was he worried about the officers that he was sending into that apartment, whether or not there were unleashed dogs that may attack the officers, whether or not there was weapons that might have a problem for anybody else who was inside that particular apartment? What would be the distinction, from a legal point of view, why would a court make a distinction between safety of the public, like whether or not a vandal breaks into the back of a car, or the safety of an officer who's executing a search warrant at the time? What would be the legal distinction, or the moral distinction for that matter, for having that type of distinction?
Well, the Ninth Circuit in Martinez made that distinction by establishing a different rule for the public safety exception, saying that it only applies in circumstances in which law enforcement reasonably suspects a potentially volatile situation. If the court were to follow the Ninth Circuit test, then arguably the second statement that you referenced in the beginning of your argument here on the Miranda subjects might be problematic. I'm not sure the Ninth Circuit has that correct, however, but that issue aside, you started to say, as a threshold matter, the panel would not be even able to reach the public safety exception. I'm not concerned, personally, I'm not concerned about the Terry stop issue. I don't think that's the question. I think the question has to do with the inquiry about weapons. And why wouldn't that issue raise a Miranda question?
Well, for multiple things. One is what I was telling the court is that in the Terry stop type situation, you're not entitled to Miranda warnings, mm-hmm. even though you're not free to go. They said that's not the type of situation in which Miranda warnings are required. And imagine for a second, the situation that as it would be if you said, yes, they have to give Miranda warnings. They stop an individual, they attempt to identify the individual, and now before they say anything else to the individual, they got to say, okay, look, even though we don't have probable cause to believe that you've committed a crime at this point, let me tell you what your Miranda warnings are. Now let me ask you a question about officer safety. That doesn't make any sense to in real life as to what an officer is doing out there.
The question wasn't about officer safety in the vicinity of the defendant. The question had to do with what is in the apartment where he isn't even located.
Well, yeah, except for he knows, and this came out at the hearing, was that he knows that there is a search warrant being drafted and the officers are about to have to enter that particular apartment. So the fact that this particular defendant wasn't there currently at the time, and it's a homicide situation, and they're about to enter an apartment where there's a lot of unknowns for an officer executing a search warrant inside that apartment. Certainly, their concern for officer safety was legitimate. I don't think anyone would suggest that Detective Brancini wasn't concerned about his safety when asking the question.
So are you saying the public safety exception governs that query?
Well, I would say if you find that Miranda warnings were required, public safety exception covers that query. But I would say, like the court did in Johnson and Billings, that preliminary questions, you run up on a guy, handcuff him, and you say, what happened? Where's the gun? Those type of questions aren't subject of Miranda. So Miranda was created as a prophylactic rule for police interrogation, where there's a coercive environment. These officers just took a guy into custody, asked him his name, and asked him if there's anything inside there to suggest that Mirandas were required, which I think is what the court was saying in Berkever versus McCarty is, they're just not that, they're not required for that purpose. But I would say if the court wants to carve out and say Miranda warnings were required, I think at the very least that certainly the officer's desire for public safety, not his desire to further investigation, because there was absolutely no evidence that he intended to elicit an incriminating response whatsoever. There was a few other things that I want to address in my last 2 minutes and 55 seconds, and it's because I think that the brief for the defense either misconstrues, misinterprets, or misrepresents the record. As to the prior threats in this particular case, there are two prior threats that will become relevant. The defense says that they objected to those prior threats, and the answer to that question is they did not. The first day of trial, they said, hey, you know, can you tell us exactly which one of the prior threats you're going to get into, because there's a number of ones in the discovery, because they may or may not be hearsay. The next morning, I informed Mr. Silverstein, hey, we're going to get into the phone call with Stu Bivens where she hears, or he's there when the victim is told, I'm going to bash your face in, and further. And then there's a conversation with Debbie Arnault in which Debbie Arnault witnesses a confrontation between the defendant and the sister. Those are the only two that we're going to get into. What happened was during the testimony of Stu Bivens, Ms. Weckerly asks the question of Stu Bivens after the basher face comes in, without objection, it's not an excited utterance or hearsay, in which she says, what was her demeanor like? And after that, Stu Bivens says, without any prompting, well, she was scared, you know, she was always afraid that he was going to shoot her in the face. At that point, the court had an outside the presence hearing in which he canvassed Mr. Bivens about when she said it, whether or not it followed under an excited utterance. At the end of that hearing, the defense doesn't object that it's not relevant and doesn't object that it wasn't an excited utterance. What they say is, Judge, we'd like to be able to cross-examine him in such a way that it doesn't come out that Sue Bivens had said this on a number of other occasions, and they work out a way to do so. There wasn't ever an objection to that portion of the testimony based on relevance or hearsay. The same thing with Debbie Arnault. During the testimony of Debbie Arnault, she witnesses a confrontation, and then immediately thereafter, Sue Bivens says something to her. There was no objection to what Sue Bivens said to her as hearsay or irrelevant. What happened was, is when I asked the question, which was, I believe I said, at some point in time, did you witness a conversation between defendant and the wife? And the response was, yeah, it was after the restraining order. Well, there wasn't any restraining order. The defense approached the bench and said there's no restraining order. There's a discussion where there's a harassment report. The judge makes a record and instructs the jury. The defense never objects to the obstruction of the court to the jury and never requests any other instruction be provided to the jury.
Well, the judge makes clear there was no restraining order too, right?
Correct.
To the jury.
He says there's no restraining order. There was a harassment report. And you know that would have been relevant to establish the date of this particular communication. But other than that, I had already agreed that we weren't going to get into the contents of the harassment report, and we never did. So unless the court has any other question, that covers my time.
Did you finish your thought on this?
Well, I did. I just think that if you actually read the record, there are allegations that somehow, one, we either went back on our word, or two, that there was evidence admitted that they objected to, I would think both of those allegations are false.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justices. Excuse me. As to the bad act evidence, it's incumbent on the state to ask for a limiting instruction, and if the state doesn't do it, it's incumbent on the lower court. That wasn't done. It's not incumbent on us to do that, although we did object and we did approach. The harassment report, per se, paints him to be a stalker-esque type of person, which goes against, is very prejudicial against him to the jury. I wanted to hit a couple more things before my time runs out, specifically Byford, and this note to Mr. Nickmeyer. Byford, you know, deliberation remains a critical element of the mens rea necessary to make out first-degree murder. We absolutely would have, if we had been given the opportunity, we would have discussed what we would have asked the lower court to do. If it came out that it said, what's the difference between first-degree and second-degree murder, we would have asked for a clarifying instruction to say, the difference between premeditation and deliberation is weighing the consequences for and against whether or not someone's going to conduct this act. The results of this trial could have been very different because the note has conveyed by Mr. Nickmeyer indicated they wanted to know the difference between first and second degree murder. Amongst other things, that I believe is at a minimum what we would have done. Well, we don't know because we don't have the note. It was gone. It's not in the court file. It is harmless error because of that reason. I mean, harmful error. I'm sorry. Regarding Mr. Cottrell being a suspect on the day of the decedent's demise, this was a Wednesday. He typically took his kids to school. He didn't have an alibi for what had happened that day. We had learned that his divorce with his wife was very contentious and that Susan was a good friend of Vilma's. And we weren't allowed to even get into laying a foundation to show that. We were shut down and excluded from that theory of our defense. Regarding the Terry stop that the state mentioned, it wasn't a Terry stop. It was a de facto arrest. Mr. Lamb wasn't patted down. He was handcuffed immediately and put on the ground. This wasn't a Terry stop. He should have been Mirandized before he was asked those questions that could have incriminated him, which did and which came out and the jury heard. I see we have about 20 seconds left.
As that last issue, Giacomo makes a point in terms of the question I asked about public safety versus officer safety. What do you say about that issue?
Well, Mr. Giacomo stated that they were going to go in with a search warrant. They didn't have a search warrant at that point. He was nowhere near the apartment. I guess if he had a spring-loaded gun, they would have been in danger. But
they had staked out the apartment upon his exiting the apartment. I don't know whether it was 100 feet or 100 yards, didn't they stop him at that point and begin to restrain?
Yes. He was nowhere near the apartment. And they could have waited and gotten their search warrant. Bring in SWAT and take whatever measures necessary that they are trained to do and that they have the resources to utilize to do that for officer safety.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you, counsel, for your briefs and your arguments this morning. The court will be in recess until 11:30.